Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this edition of the Knowing the Truth radio program. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. So glad that you joined us on the broadcast today. Well, President Obama promised that he would bend the health care cost curve, but he's bent it in the wrong direction. He did bend it, like he said he would, but he said he was going to bend it down, and the prices are actually going up. Premiums and deductibles are skyrocketing, and Obamacare has entered what experts are referring to as, grimly, I should say, referring to as a death spiral. Thinking about the basically what has become the national health care system, over the last year, at the fastest rate that it has jumped in, looking to dodge the political blame for Obamacare's spectacularly deeply higher health care costs, Democrats and their insurers settled on a poll-tested strategy of pretending that it's prescription drugs that are the principal driver of these higher costs. But is that really true? Is that does the data show that? Or does the data show that something else is wrong? Well, who better to talk to about that subject than Phil Kirpin? Phil is the president of the American Commitment, and you can go out to their website at www.americancommitment.org to read the article that we're going to talk about on the program today. It's entitled Obamacare, Not Drug Prices, is to Blame for Record High Healthcare Costs. Phil, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Hey, great to be with you.
Well, Phil, here we go again. I had hoped that the next time that we talked to you about Obamacare, we would have some good news to talk about. But unfortunately, things seem to be getting worse and worse, and here we are again with the prices skyrocketing and the blame being spread all over the place. What's going on?
Well, you mentioned the term death spiral, and that's actually what they call it in the insurance industry, believe it or not. They might pick a more sensitive term, given that we're talking about people's health, but that is what they call it in the insurance industry. And basically what's happening is younger, healthier people are not buying into Obamacare for a few reasons, but mostly because it's not worth it for them. They're making an economically rational choice that, given the high premiums, high deductibles, it just doesn't make sense. Even if, you know, many of them qualify for exemptions from the individual mandate penalty tax, but even if they have to pay the penalty tax, they're better off than they are paying, you know, three times as much in premiums for a plan where if they ever actually use it, they're going to have to pay out of pocket anyway because of the deductible. And so what's happened is the risk pools have skewed older and sicker than the general population. Claims have come in higher than anticipated. And the insurance companies have either given up completely and quit, and United Health has quit the exchanges completely. Humana's left about 88% of the counties they were in nationally. Aetna's left about 75% of the counties they were in nationally. And even Blue Cross is now beginning to pull out in some places. For instance, in Tennessee, Blue Cross quit the three largest markets in the state, Knoxville, Nashville, and Memphis. All right? And we've seen in Nebraska the Blue Cross plan pull out. In Minnesota, the Blue Cross plan pull out. And the plans that are not pulling out, giving up and pulling out, they're filing very, very large premium increases. And the state regulators are approving them. In some cases, they're approving even larger than requested premium increases because the math doesn't work anyway. It's not possible to pay the claims out given that the risk pools have been much older and much sicker than anticipated. And so the Obama administration estimates premiums are going up 25% on average nationally. I think that is a lowball estimate. For instance, the Obama administration claims premiums are going down 3% in Indiana. That's part of what they have in that 25% average. The Indiana Department of Insurance says that's totally false. In fact, they're going up at least 18.7% in Indiana. So it's still not as bad as some other places, but definitely a lowball in the official Obama administration data, which makes you wonder how many other states they have wrong. The worst increase is in the state of Arizona, where it's more than 100%, and in the Phoenix market in particular, premiums are going up 145%. But that's not the only place that's going kind of haywire. It's above 60% in Tennessee. It's above 60% in Minnesota. It's above 60% in Oklahoma. We're looking at, I think, 24% in North Carolina, 35%, I think, in South Carolina. And a lot of these places are down to just one remaining insurance company. And so, for instance, Blue Cross Blue Shield is the only insurance company left in South Carolina. It's the only insurance company left in North Carolina, except for a couple of counties around Raleigh where Cigna's offering plans. We're in a situation where the basic model in these exchanges isn't working. It doesn't work. And it's really the fault of two things in the Obamacare designs that are causing this. One of them is the benefit design, the so-called essential health benefits. And the law itself just had a list of 10 things that every plan has to cover. And some of them people have criticized, I think, legitimately. Things like pediatric, dental, and vision has to be covered even if you don't have any kids. Maternity and newborn care has to be covered even if you're a single man or if you're a couple past childbearing age. So there have been some quibbles just with the 10 things that Congress listed, but really where it went off the rails is when the HHS bulletin came out defining what the 10 things actually mean in practice, and they wrote hundreds and hundreds of pages essentially dictating the plan design for every plan in the country. It now has to meet this micromanaged design written out of Washington, and so that has really constrained choices and made it so the plans are very similar in terms of benefit design. Even if someone might be looking for something else, there's very little choice and competition in that regard. And the other thing that's really driving this problem is in the age band regulation. And this is a part of Obamacare. It actually was written into the law at the urging of AARP, which was one of the major special interests that was part of writing this law, that says that the youngest person in a health plan cannot be charged any less than one-third what the oldest person in a health plan is charged. So it's a 3-to-1 ratio of the oldest to the youngest people in a plan. Well, the actuaries say that ratio should be more like 6-to-1. It's about 6 times more expensive for the oldest people in a plan to cover their claims than the youngest people in a plan. So when you require by law a 3-to-1 ratio, you're basically charging younger people double what the actual value of the health plan is to them. And when you're charging people double, you shouldn't be surprised when a lot of them won't buy the product, even if they have to pay a penalty tax for not buying it.
Yeah.
That's the situation that we're in.
I was going to ask you about that because there's something that seems to be confusing to me about the idea of the insurance company pullout. One is, I thought that many of them were, in cahoots with Obama on this, and so they were getting some sort of benefit to it. So I wanted to see if you could explain to us how it is then that they're pulling out. Were they really in cahoots in the beginning or not? And secondly, even after they so-called pull out of this, they're still, and you've touched on this somewhat here, they're still regulated kind of by Obamacare rules, right? So they can't just do whatever they want to do. I still can't go back to them and get my old major medical program from them with a high deductible. There's all kinds of rules that they now have to apply to because of Obamacare as well. Could you answer those couple of questions?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right that the insurance companies were in cahoots on this thing. And in fact, the principal staff author of Obamacare, when it was being written in the Senate Finance Committee, was a staffer for Max Baucus's staff, the senator from Montana at the time, named Liz Fowler. And Liz Fowler came directly from Anthem. She was their top lobbyist, and then she went to work for the Senate, and she wrote the blueprint of this thing. And it was written to be very favorable to health insurance companies. And don't shed a tear for the health insurance companies. Mm-hmm. Every health insurance company stock has more than doubled since Obamacare passed. They've done very, very well. And I think the main reason they've done so well is the Medicaid expansion. Remember, this law changes the rules for Medicaid. The Supreme Court made this optional for states, so it hasn't happened everywhere the way that the law's writers wanted, but it still has happened in the majority of states. They changed the Medicaid eligibility rules so that able-bodied working-age adults can go on the Medicaid program. Historically, that was a program for children and for disabled people, families with children and for disabled people. You add able-bodied working-age adults, that's a huge new population, and in fact, you know, 15 to 20 million more people are now on the Medicaid rolls in this country as a consequence of Obamacare. Most states do not provide Medicaid benefits directly. They contract it out with one of these insurance companies in Medicaid-managed care contracts, and that has really been a cash cow for the insurance companies. They've done very, very well, and their profits from that business have much more than offset their losses from the Obamacare exchange business, where, you know, where middle-class people go onto these exchanges and buy. And so even with the large losses they've been taking in the exchange business, they've done very well from the law overall. Now, that said, they certainly did not anticipate losing money on the exchange business. They thought that would be another big profit center for them when they passed this law. And they thought that because they assumed we've got all of this money coming in subsidies from taxpayers, and people are going to be punished with a penalty if they don't comply with the mandate. We're requiring everyone by law to buy a product, and we're heavily subsidizing it. You would think between those two things, this would be a great, great business to be in. And in fact, when this law was being debated, the big argument from Democrats was they're going to be, the profits are going to be too big. They're going to be these obscene, massive profits, and that's why there should be a government plan in there competing with them, a public option. And that ended up not making the cut to get the last few Democratic votes. Some of the less liberal Democrats were against that idea, and it ended up not making the cut. But they thought there were going to be these huge profits because of the subsidies and because of the mandate. And they were wrong about that because of the flaws in the regulatory design that I mentioned. They just haven't been able to get younger people and healthy people to comply, even with the mandate. And so they thought this was going to be another huge profitable business for them when they helped write this law, and they certainly were in cahoots on it. And it just hasn't worked for them. And frankly, yeah, I don't shed a tear for them for it not working. I mean, they kind of deserve it because they wanted this thing and they supported it, and they still haven't, for the most part, called for repeal or major change. Their big solution, what the insurance companies are calling for, is they want a direct corporate bailout. They want to basically say, hey, we'll keep participating in this totally broken, flawed market of dollars of taxpayer money in direct payments. Well, that's not a solution, good money after bad. And so the insurance companies still haven't sort of think they can make money off it, by it. And now I've forgotten your second question.
Well, the second one was that of the exchanges, they're still highly regulated by a lot of the...
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. Yeah. The off-exchange products are still heavily regulated in a very similar way to the exchange products. There's not much difference. So the entire individual insurance market is being crippled by these same regulations, whether companies participate in the exchange or not. It's really a problem throughout the individual insurance market. And some of these companies may pull out of offering individual policies completely and just focus on the employer's business and on their Medicaid managed care business.
Hmm. Now, folks like myself, for right now, we've been able to go around it by using somebody like Samaritan Purse or something like that. But I would imagine that where all this is going is, at least they said in the beginning, this is what they were hoping, that it was all going to basically fall apart, and they're going to use the failure of it to say, well, we really then need a single-payer government program. Is this all where we're heading, to the single-payer program?
I think that's where most of the left would like to go, although there still is, I think, a political fear to be open about it and to admit it publicly, and that's why they try to be a little guarded in the language they use. But it's important to remember that that whole debate we had about the public option, about having a government-run plan in the exchanges competing with the private plans, really was designed as a bridge to getting everyone into a government-run single-payer type system where everyone's in a government plan and it's the only plan there is. And I know that because the originator, the inventor of the idea of a public option, was a Yale professor named Jacob Hacker, and he was at a conference of the Tides Foundation, a major liberal donor conference, and he was asked this question, you know, Republicans are saying the public option's a Trojan horse for single-payer, can you address it? And it's amazing. There's video of this. It's pretty easy to find on YouTube. What he said was, It's not a Trojan horse at all. Mm. It's right there. I'm telling you that that's the plan. We're going to get public options side by side with private insurance. We're going to cripple the private insurance with regulations. Everyone's going to be in the government plan. And then before you know it, it'll be the only plan left. And so he wasn't even trying to hide it. He said, yeah, that's the plan. That's why we want the public option so that we can get everyone into it and then get rid of the private insurance and have a government-run single-payer type system. And in fact, Hillary Clinton is now expressly campaigning on the idea of adding a public option to Obamacare. Well, we all know from the guy who came up with the idea of the public option that that is a way to move everyone into that plan, to cripple the private plans, and then have it be the only thing left. I mean, it's not a secret. It's right there in front of us. And so it's not a conspiracy theory. That is the that's the objective here. That's where they want to go. And, you know, they weren't able to get that piece of the puzzle into Obamacare. But think for a second where we'd be right now if they had that public option passed. If the government-run plan were in Obamacare and all the rules and regulations and all the problems that we're seeing were happening, all the private insurance companies are leaving, we'd be very far on the way to exactly what Jacob Hacker described.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I'm not sure that at this point I can tell the difference between what we currently have and what the public plan would be. It seems pretty public to me. I seem to be paying for an awful lot of it. And so, you know, I guess basically what we're saying is it can get a lot worse.
Well, that's a good point, too. I mean, if, you know, 33%, a third of the country only has one insurance company left in Obamacare. Okay, another third has two companies left. But if you only have one company left in Obamacare, okay, it's probably a Blue Cross plan. It might be something else, but it's heavily regulated. They're very closely tied in with all the regulators. In fact, in some counties, we've seen the prospects of zero plans, and then, you know, the regulators will go negotiate with the company and come to terms on bringing them back in with some huge premium increase and what the plan structure looks like and so on and so forth. If you've only got one choice, and that choice is being tightly regulated, controlled, negotiated between the government and the notionally private entity that's offering it, don't you kind of already have single payer in that third of the country that only has one choice in Obamacare? And so, yeah, you're right. It's not a government plan per se in that the ownership of the entity that's providing the plan is not the government, but it's already pretty close in that it's tightly controlled by government. And so it's not all that different. And all of the problems attendant with single payer, the lack of choice, the lack of competition, the heavy bureaucratic control, the lack of real decision-making authority being between the patient and doctor, we're already there in a lot of places. We're already very far down this line, even if the plans remain notionally private.
Well, before, when they first brought this out, you know, the demon was the insurance company themselves. And they said, well, you know, these guys are the ones that are ripping you off. And so we're here to rescue you. The government's going to, you know, get involved here. We're going to have Obamacare and everything's going to be wonderful. That didn't work out, obviously. It's going in this death spiral that we've been discussing. But now they don't seem to be able to blame the insurance companies since they were so closely associated with them. And because so many of them are dropping out, The big enemy now seems to be the drug costs, as your article points out. You know that it's the drug companies and the cost of drugs. Does that really hold water?
No, the numbers don't support it at all. And this is just something, you know, this came out of their polling and their focus groups, and the Democrats realized, you know, I could have told them this, that everyone hates the drug companies. They're very unpopular. You know, when your business is making money selling people medicine that they need and making profits off that, you know, a lot of people have a little bit of unease about that. And you know, that's kind of unavoidable, but it's also kind of necessary because it costs billions and billions of dollars to develop new drugs. If there isn't a return on capital, if there aren't profits to be had, you'll never raise the money to do it. You won't develop new cures. And so it's got to have, there has to be that incentive in the system to keep getting miracle cures. And what we're seeing in the data is that healthcare costs overall are rising at the fastest rate in about 30 years, and hospital costs and doctor costs and health insurance costs are going up much faster than prescription drug costs. Prescription drug costs are actually growing more slowly than any of the other major components of healthcare spending in this country in the most recent data. And this is the crucial point for anyone who says prescription drug costs are the big driver why healthcare spending is out of control. Prescription drug spending is 10% of healthcare spending in this country. 10%, one-tenth. It is not mathematically possible for a component of healthcare spending that is only one-tenth of overall healthcare spending to be the major cost driver. And it's not. And frankly, when a lot of these talking points were developed a couple of years ago, prescription drug spending was growing pretty rapidly. In 2014, it was the fastest growing segment of healthcare costs, but there was a very, very good reason for that. That was the year that hepatitis C cures were available for the first time. And they're expensive, but you're cured of the disease when you're done. And that is a disease that had never previously been cured, and all of these cures came out. They were competing. It's something we should celebrate, not that we should flag as a fear and a danger that prescription drug costs jumped in that 1 year. They jumped for a very good reason. And in fact, I'm really worried that if we have a president who supports prescription drug price controls, and both presidential candidates have said they might support prescription drug price controls. I think Hillary Clinton has been much worse on this. She very clearly wants it. Donald Trump has at times suggested he would as well. If you do that, if you impose government price controls on prescription drugs, in the near term, that feels good for people because they're going to the pharmacy, they're paying a little less. That feels good. They're probably going to be appreciative politically, and that's why politicians like this idea. But what you won't see is that next miracle cure that can't get developed because they can't raise the billions of dollars that it takes to do the research and development and all the testing and to go through the regulatory approval process and bring it to market if there isn't the prospect of a big return on investment. And we might not see that Alzheimer cure or that cancer cure as a consequence of those prescription drug price controls. And so I think this is, of all the policies that are being proposed right now in the healthcare space, this is the most frightening and most dangerous one because it messes up the crucial central incentive that's going to get us the next great cure. And so I really hope that whichever one of them wins, we can move them off this idea of imposing price controls on prescription drugs. And I think if it's Trump, we probably can, because you can have Republican personnel in the different agencies who will kind of get the market incentive issue. But I really fear that if Hillary Clinton wins, we're going to be dealing with price controls on prescription drugs, and it's going to make it much harder to do medical research and to actually cure diseases.
Well, assuming Trump is better, like you were saying, on this issue, he's been talking about undoing Obamacare the last couple of days and so forth, and assuming then that he wins, he calls up Phil Kirpin from the American Commitment. He says, Phil, come on board. We got to fix this thing. Can we even, is it so insidious now? Is it so wrapped into the current system? Can we actually undo this at this point? I mean, would we have to scrap the whole thing and start over? Would there be certain major pieces that you would say this has to be fixed or so forth? What would you do? First couple of days as the final question, like it's going to be a quick one, right? But the final question, could it be done? And what would be the first thing that you would do?
Well, so many of the things that have been done that have been such disasters in Obamacare were administrative decisions that were made after the law passed, which means that a lot of it can be undone by a new president before he even goes through the whole congressional process of trying to repeal and replace it or overhaul it and fix it, whatever happens legislatively. So the initial steps should focus on the things you can do administratively. For instance, social health benefit rules that I mentioned, make a much wider variety of plans available in terms of so on. That could be greatly loosened up even within the current law. That would make a grant state innovation waivers, not just for Medicaid, but for the Obamacare program as well. All of it together, take a big bucket of money and to run innovative with pre-existing conditions while having a functioning marketplace for everyone else. And so I think that waivers for the states are crucial, deregulating some of the plan structure and design so you can have more choices and so forth. Those are the kinds of things you could do right away on day one to open this thing up. I would also consider a blanket waiver for the individual mandate and for the employer mandate. I don't think we should punish people for not buying into a bad system that doesn't have good options for them. I think that would relieve a lot of the pressure and a lot of the political anger, buy you some time to do the reforms in Congress. And then after you do sort of those initial administrative actions that you can do unilaterally as president, I think you got to go to Congress. And at a minimum, depending on the lay of the land, if you've got to deal with a Democratic filibuster or whatever, you've got to loosen that age band regulation that requires charging twice what you ought to younger people. If you can't fix that, you can't stabilize the risk pool. That ought to be an easy ask. You're going to be going up against AARP, but you know, they can be defeated, especially if you've got Republican control up there. That would be another near-term measure that I think would make a big difference. And then I think you work for 2 years, really, for a year and a half. You put the effort into doing a comprehensive repeal and replace, where you move away from the idea of centralized control. You put individuals in charge of their own health care dollars, give them choices, give them a functioning marketplace. But you do it all through a reasoned legislative process on camera in front of the American people with buy-in from the American people that they can feel good about. You do the opposite of the corrupt closed-door process that the Democrats did that resulted in Obamacare, because a poisonous process almost guarantees a poisonous result. So you don't say, I've got it all figured out, here's my bill, go pass it tomorrow. You do the immediate near-term relief actions that you can right away, but then you really, I think, start a good, honest, above-board, visible process on how you repeal this whole law and replace it with something better. And that's how I would approach it as president. I wouldn't prejudge the outcome of that process, but I definitely would provide that immediate relief first and then start that process.
Well, Phil, I'm all for it. I hope the new president, whoever it is, hope it's Trump. But if he gets on board, then I pray that they give you a call and have you come in there and help them to fix this thing, because it certainly is something that needs to be fixed. And you're a guy that has the ability to articulate it and certainly to help us to understand what in the world's going on with this behemoth.
Well, I got a lot of friends over there on the campaign. I wouldn't be shocked if they asked me, but I got four small kids, so I don't know if I can handle the schedule of actually being in an administration, but I guess we'll cross that bridge if it comes to it.
Well, we're looking forward to it. Phil, thank you so much for taking time away from your schedule to join us today to talk with us about it. We really appreciate it.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay. That was Phil Kirpin. He's the president of American Commitment. You can check out the article that we've been discussing during the program today. This was the one dealing with drug costs being the new scapegoat for the Democratic Party in order to try to escape blame for the death spiral that is currently taking place among Obamacare. You can read that article out at American Commitment, but a lot more is out there as well. Their website is www.americancommitment. That's all one word, americancommitment.org. Go out there and read those articles. Very informative.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.